Seacoast.com. My name is Howard Altschuler, executive editor at Seacoast Media Group. I believe I have spoken with just about everyone in this room today at some point or other. We're pleased today to host Illinois Senator and Democratic presidential candidate Barack Obama for a community forum and discussion on health care. We've set aside 90 minutes, so there should be enough time for some really good give and take. And I've met with most of you folks, and there's a lot of good give and take available in this group. In many ways, our healthcare system shows this nation at its best and its worst. Like many of you, I know this from personal experience. This November, my wife was diagnosed with Hodgkin's lymphoma, a form of blood cancer. During her months of treatment, we've seen doctors who were skillful and heroic nurses who made sickening treatments bearable with their caring kindness. But we've also seen a pill called Zofran that cost $1.50 under one insurance program and $50 under another insurance program. And then when you get to mail order, it costs you about a quarter. So you got to try to make some sense of that. We see the bills come in, and we know that if we didn't have insurance, and pretty good insurance, we would have been destroyed financially. And even with good insurance, every day is a test of our will. So that's my healthcare story, and today's a good day to share healthcare stories because Senator Obama is in a position to work to make things better. Please, when you speak, state your name first like you would do at a town meeting, and also wait for one of these lovely volunteers from the campaign to bring you a microphone so that everyone can hear what you have to say. I should also have everyone in the room know, particularly the local folks, our readers, that while we're hosting Senator Obama today, we've personally invited and spoken to personally all the other major presidential candidates. They're invited to come to this building to meet the people of the Seacoast and to talk about things that really matter. That's the great responsibility of hosting the First in the Nation primary. What we say and do really can make a difference. So let's try to make the most of that opportunity today. With that said, please join me in a warm welcome for Senator Barack Obama.
Thank you, everybody. Thank you so much. Let me begin by thanking everybody who helped to organize this. I want to start with Howard Altschuler for helping to coordinate this. Thank you so much. I want to thank John Tabor, the publisher here. I want to thank Alan Lasky at the press shop because we shut down the press shop. I'm very grateful to all of you. I want to make sure that I didn't miss anybody. Michael McCord, thank you so much of the Portsmouth Herald. Sher Haberman, who's been doing some great reporting on this issue. And although generally we've got people who are here for their stories, I do want to acknowledge that we've got your Congresswoman, Carol Shea Porter, who's here. She's here somewhere. There she is. Thank you very much, Carol, for being here. Well, look, this is the first time that we have done this in the campaign, but it's not going to be the last. Don't worry, you're not guinea pigs. I think this will work relatively well. I taught con law for 10 years, so I'm used to calling on people. But here was the idea. I have always found that I learn the most and the favorite aspect of my work as an elected official in community meetings. Partly this is because I started as a community organizer. I'm not a native of Chicago. I moved to Chicago when I was in my early 20s because I was working with a group of churches that were trying to deal with the devastation of steel plants that had closed. And thousands had been laid off. Homes had been foreclosed. Commercial strips had been shuttered. And they wanted to see what could be done to pull the community together, rebuild it. And they didn't have a lot of money, so they hired me. That's all they could afford. And I remember getting paid $10,000 plus $2,000 to buy a car, because I didn't have one at the time. But the 3 years that I spent there setting up job training programs and organizing the community around various other community issues, it was the best education that I ever had, because I learned to listen and found out that ordinary people can do extraordinary things when they're given an opportunity to participate in the major decisions that impact their lives. I went from there to the state legislature, and in the state legislature, I helped to pass programs to provide health insurance to kids who didn't have it before, or to lower prescription drug costs for senior citizens, based on what I was hearing in community meetings as a state legislator. And so it's that idea that my job as a representative of my state, Illinois, and now potentially as the President of the United States and somebody who's representing the entire country, my job is not just to come in with a predisposed agenda, but it's to actually listen and learn and hopefully translate that into action. Now, one of the challenges in government is the fact that getting movement on the major challenges we face is increasingly difficult. And the reason is not because we lack good policies that are available to us, but rather because we have found ourselves divided from our government. We are not setting the agenda in Washington, and oftentimes we're not setting the agenda in state capitals around the country. All too often, lobbyists, special interests, those who have access are able to preempt the agenda that ordinary folks might set if they were there. And I'm proud of the fact that I've spent a lot of my political career trying to fight against that trend. So the first bill I passed when I was in the state legislature was a bill that instituted campaign ethics reforms, the first in 25 years in that state. And they were resisted both by Republicans, but also by my fellow Democrats. I was not popular that year. Young rookie coming in, passing laws that restricted the access and the gifts and perks that lobbyists could confer on legislators. Just last year, I worked with Russ Feingold to do the same in toughening some of the campaign ethics reforms, lobbyist reforms that were needed in Washington. Because I think all of us recognize that if you've got insurance companies or drug companies or oil companies writing legislation, that their interests rather than ordinary voters' interests are more likely to be represented. Nowhere is that more true than in healthcare. We all know the statistics because the problems that we face are not new. We have a situation in which half of all bankruptcies at this point are prompted as a consequence of a medical crisis and lack of insurance or underinsurance. We know that we are spending $2 trillion on a healthcare system, which is more than twice what the average in other industrialized countries are paying for their healthcare, and yet we've got not only care that is just as good, we actually in some cases have care that is worse, or at least outcomes that are worse than these other countries. We are spending only about 5 cents of every dollar in healthcare on prevention services. We are not properly managing people who have chronic illnesses. We have a healthcare system that is probably the only industry in America that still relies on paper records. Somehow we have not been able to apply technology to it. And as a consequence, we've got a system that is bankrupting families, bankrupting our governments, and is not actually creating healthier Americans. And the question is, why not? Why haven't we done something significant about it? Why is it that we still have 47 million who are uninsured? Why do we still have 9 million children who are uninsured? It's not because people don't recognize there's a problem. It's because there's been a bottleneck in our government in addressing it. And so my hope today is that we can not just hear good stories from you and important stories from you about how the health system is affecting you, but that this can be a process where we start building a movement for change. I've got some ideas about how we can fix the system. Some of them I wrote about in my recent book, The Audacity of Hope. And, yeah, my thank you. You read it. Yeah. And some of the ideas involve applying medical technology to reduce bureaucracy, putting more money in prevention, dealing with the management of the chronically ill, taking those savings and helping people who don't have health insurance or are underinsured to buy into a pool where they can buy group rates so that small businesses and self-employed and individuals can participate. I've got a range of ideas, and I'll talk about some of those ideas during the course of this forum. But what I've also said is that the reason we have not had the kind of healthcare system that we need is not because of a lack of good plans. Every 4 years, presidential candidates trot out a healthcare plan. You all have heard them, assuming you were voters in New Hampshire. Every election cycle, people have healthcare plans. What's preventing us from implementing them is that we don't build a constituency that is going to hold elected officials accountable for actually implementing those plans. And so part of the reason that I want all of you engaged in this process in shaping the plan is I also want all of you to be participants in forcing that plan to actually move through Washington. And as president, I am committed to certain principles. I am committed to the principle that spending as much money as we are, it is inexcusable that we still have as many uninsured as we do. I believe that by the end of my first term in office, that we will have a universal health care system instituted in this country. That is a commitment that I've made, and it is a commitment I want to be held accountable for. In addition to ensuring that everybody has coverage, I want to make sure that it is coverage that is providing people with the health care that they need. It's not going to help us if we provide universal coverage that's substandard and does not provide, you know, regular checkups or regular mammograms or other important aspects of primary care. So I want us to be able to set some standards to make sure that we're getting, you know, a bang for our health care dollar. I want to make sure that we're applying savings to the system, that we're rationalizing the system and making it more efficient. And I want to make sure that we're addressing some of the issues of our public health infrastructure. You know, if we ensured that every senior got a flu shot during flu season, we could save $1 billion a year in costs, which is an astonishing rate. If we returned to the rate of obesity that we had back in 1980, the Medicare system over the long term could save $1 trillion. I mean, we now have 65% of adults are obese or overweight, and about a third of healthcare inflation is as a result of those changes in our basic health. So I've got a set of principles that I'm going to be putting forward, but again, I'm not going to be able to do it by myself. This is going to have to be an agenda that all of you embrace and that we build nationwide so that when I come in, not only do you have a president who's committed to universal health care in 4 years' time, but you've got a Congress that's committed to the same. The last point I'll make, and then we're going to start opening it up. I am a Democrat. I am considered a progressive Democrat. And I've got some clear ideas in terms of how I think we can help move this agenda forward. But I also want to remain open-minded to ideas from all sources. You know, if a Republican or a conservative or a libertarian or a free marketer has a better idea, a more efficient way for us to make sure that people are healthy and are gaining affordable coverage, I am happy to steal ideas from anybody. You know, in that sense, I'm agnostic. And I think that's the attitude that we're going to have to bring to this process, because nobody has a monopoly on good ideas. And if we get ideologically rigid in terms of how this has to be achieved, then it's going to be hard for us to actually build the kinds of coalitions that are going to need to make it happen. Okay? All right. With that, what I want to do is to start opening it up. There are no rules. As I think was mentioned earlier, the newspaper selected all of you randomly, but also based on some of the stories that you had to tell. I want to listen to your stories. I want to hear from you. The only rule would be that if you could introduce yourself before you speak, that would be helpful. And what I'm going to do is conduct this a little bit like my law school class, which means that, you know, if you have a good story or you're making a good point, I may want to follow up with you a little bit so that it's more of a conversation instead of us just one after another saying what we've got to say. All right? Okay, who wants to start off? Yes, right here. And you have to introduce this young lady also. Here, we've got a mic right behind you.
Hi, it's a pleasure to meet you. My name is Andrea Ardito, and this is my 9-year-old daughter, Olivia Ardito. I took her out of school to come see you.
Hey, Olivia. Thank you for coming.
Thank you for having us. My question to you is also sort of a comment. I'm a mother of three. My last child that I just had, he's 2 years old. We paid out of pocket to have him because we couldn't afford to have the kind of insurance that would pay for prenatal care. I remember almost passing out when I got a $700 bill for a blood test. So we found that it would be cheaper to pay out of pocket than to have my son than to actually carry an insurance, which led to different decisions being made. For my care, my husband joked, listen, if you go in, if you have Henry really quickly, and then get out of there, you could spend a week at the Wentworth, you know? It's like, okay, I can do that. So,
did it work? Is that what you did?
Sort of. I was 3 hours. I was pretty good.
That's okay.
But my point is, my husband is self-employed. I'm not working right now, and it's just a struggle. It's a constant struggle. We take care of ourselves, but I'm marching towards the mammogram years really quickly, and I don't have the money to pay for that kind of thing that's going to be coming up for my kids, too. And the system is just broken, and I am hopeful that you will come in and change the system, and you have my vote and my family's vote. And my daughter ran for president, actually, when she was in kindergarten. And if she could vote, you would have her vote, too.
Let me ask you some follow-ups, though.
Sure.
So your husband's self-employed.
Yes.
You're not working right now. You've got two kids?
Three
kids. What are you doing for health insurance separate and apart from the birth of your most recent addition?
We have catastrophic insurance.
So how much are you paying for, if you don't mind me asking, do you know approximately how much you're paying?
I don't know off the top of my head. I know my husband regularly complains, but
right.
I tend to kind of tune
okay.
him out because
right.
it's just too frustrating.
Right. So so you've got catastrophic insurance.
Yes.
Presumably that means you've got a very high deductible.
We do. I believe that we would have to reach at least $10,000
right.
worth of services before it kicked in. So it's basically there if we get in a car
accident. So you don't lose
your
house.
So we don't lose our house.
Right.
Exactly.
I met a woman in Peterborough at a diner who was older than you. She was probably in her late 50s, early 60s, mm-hmm. had the exact same approach. She was self-employed.
Mm-hmm.
She... her premium might have been a little higher than yours, or it might be the same because I'm not sure she still had children in the house. But she said she was paying $6,000 a month, $6,000 a year, so $500 a month for catastrophic coverage. She had a $10,000 deductible.
Mm-hmm.
But what that meant then is, you know, if she wanted a mammogram, if she wanted a checkup for the kids, if she wanted dental care, all those things she had to pay out of pocket. Is that the same?
Yes. Yes.
Approach that you guys are
yes.
taking. Do you think that you're getting less care than you might otherwise get? Do you think you would go to the doctor more often? You
yes.
would.
I mean, I'm not a big believer in Western medicine anyway.
Right.
I'm the person that's trying to take care of myself.
You're eating right and getting
yes.
exercise.
Yes, because I can't afford to get sick.
Right.
I can't. Right. I mean, it's funny, but it's also very sad because, right. you know, I'm worried. I mean, my husband is 14 years older than I am. You know, he's takes very good care of himself. But what's going to happen if one of us gets sick?
Right.
We can't afford to get sick.
Well, thank you for the story. Look, you know. Just to extrapolate from your experience, about two-thirds of people who don't have health insurance work full-time mm-hmm. Or part-time. They are self-employed. In some cases, they may have two jobs. So your circumstance is not unusual. Now, the thing I'm worried about is if somebody, heaven forbid, in your family did get sick, you know, a $10,000 deductible is a pretty serious dent.
Oh, we wouldn't have it.
In your budget.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's as a consequence of that, a lot of people end up paying on their credit card
mm-hmm.
Or they take out a second mortgage on their home mm-hmm. in order to meet some of those deductible payments. Mm-hmm. And that's the reason why half of all personal bankruptcies now are caused by some sort of medical crisis.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Let me ask you just one last question, and that is, has your husband or others explored the possibility of, is there any kind of pool, sort of group plan that you can buy into? I don't know what he does
tried.
Professionally.
My husband's a psychologist.
Okay.
He mainly works with children.
Uh-huh.
And
is there a psychologist association or other sort of organization?
There is. He's part of Portsmouth Psychiatric Associates, and they are all together, but it's too expensive for them to buy into insurance. It's just too expensive. And New Hampshire is not that insurance friendly. That's probably putting it politely. You know, years ago, there was only a few companies that would come in. And I remember trying to switch over, and I was pregnant with my second child, and they said, well, honey, that's pregnancy is a pre-existing condition, and I think I have been pregnant, I don't know, a day or something. You know, it's very difficult to kind of wade through all the different options when there really isn't any for someone with a young family who is self-employed. So, yes, we have.
Well, thank you so much for your story.
Thank you.
I appreciate that. I'll just mention one thing. My mother was she was a consultant. She did international development work. And so she funded she would travel around the world working for various NGOs, non-governmental organizations, helping to fund programs to help women start small businesses and providing them small loans. And so she was on contract, and she oftentimes was in the same situation that your husband and you are, which is she wouldn't always have regular insurance because she didn't have a constant single employer. And when she was 53, in between jobs, she was diagnosed with ovarian cancer, and the only thing that saved her was that she still had a window to buy into Cobra. Of course, Cobra cost her $1,000 or so now, and she wasn't working. She was hospitalized, started on chemotherapy. I remember having to spend a lot of time arguing with the insurer about when she had been diagnosed with this ovarian cancer, because they started making arguments that she had a pre-existing condition. Now, she ended, the disease was so far advanced that she died in 6 months, which obviously was heartbreaking for me and my sister and our family. But had she lasted longer, she would have lost everything financially, as it was. I mean, she spent down all her resources at the end of her life. And I remember having conversations with her at the hospital bed, and she's spending time worrying about whether or not she would have anything left over if she was able to survive the illness. So this is something that, you know, self-employed folks, people with part-time jobs, it is a fact of life now throughout America. Yes. Let's wait for the mic since we've got these air conditioning units going pretty loud.
Hi, my name is Lori McCray. I live here in Portsmouth with my son, Michael Nowak. Thank you for this opportunity today.
Hey, Michael.
Well, that's, what I would like to tag on to what you were just talking about, and you were asking about, you know, do you get to participate in different groups and different plans? A couple of years ago, when our COBRA ran out, I ended up searching for health insurance. And I'm a registered nurse. I also used to run a home health agency, and I'm very familiar and know how to network and know how to get resources. I ended up, over a course of 8 months, having 5 different insurance plans for my family. It was exhausting. During this period of time, my son's had surgery, and I was also getting hounded by one of the companies because of a mistake they made in their computer system, and they were chasing me down for $13,000 we did not owe. So that was also happening. But when our COBRA ran out, I was paying $1,100 a month approximately, and we needed to get individual health insurance plans at that point in time because my husband went out into practice on his own. So I was looking for individual health insurance. Everyone in the state, because that was doing business in the state, we were no guaranteed issue for those types of plans, denied both my husband because of one medication he takes and denied my son a plan because he was born with Down syndrome. It was a permanent and automatic rejection. So I was thankfully the only healthy one in the family, and I found a great plan, $600 a month, $13,000 in deductibles. So a couple months later, what ended up happening, because part of the deal was my husband and I were on one plan with $10,000 in deductibles, and then I had the state plan, the high-risk pool plan that we were able to find for him, was $3,000 in deductibles. Please, Michael. And a couple hundred dollars extra, but I couldn't keep that going forever because it was a high-risk state plan. We ended up being forced onto Medicaid because the private for-profit private insurance industry wouldn't have him. So a couple months later, same sort of deal with the New Hampshire Medical Society. I'm thinking, oh, great, we're finally going to get a deal. It's a group plan. It's a pool. And if I hear anything more about pools, I'm going to scream.
Okay. Well, I'll be careful.
Yeah.
Because I don't want you screaming.
Right. So we got a great deal. I'm thinking $1,550 a month. That was our pool plan, 3 of us in our family. We are now paying over $2,000 a month in this great pool. My hope is that we can find a way. And in the meantime, I have an 85-year-old mother whose care I also manage, brought her here from the Detroit area to here. So I've got my son on Medicaid, my mother on Medicare, and we're paying over $2,000 a month. I have to tell you, the most efficient system out of everything we're working with is the Medicare system. I know what I'm getting. I know what I'm paying for. It's simple. There's no secrets. And I'm hoping, I wanted to give you a couple of ideas.
Please, go ahead.
I just wanted to say, I don't want more competition. I don't want to see more insurance plans. I'm comparing apples to oranges. I can't. And when there's health issues happening in a family, I don't have time to be looking and comparing apples to oranges amongst 10 different plans. It's confusing. You have when one company will raise deductibles and lower the premium, and as I did in my example, you know, or shift it the other way around, or they're shifting someone to a public assistance program. I can tell you all kinds of scamming things they do, but I'm looking for one plan. I'm looking to not compare the apples and oranges. I'm looking for no deductibles. I'm looking for no co-pays. I want a national standard that anyone, if you do decide to have private for-profit health insurance companies in a plan, I want a national standard for them to participate that would be similar to a Medicare plan. Preventative, chronic, mental health parity, and all of those issues have to be included. And they all have to participate if they're going to offer a health insurance plan, or they don't get to. And then that way, the companies that are not working for the people are out of business. And because this is not a business, healthcare is not a market, it's not an industry. And that's what I'm hoping, that we can do that, and also on the other issue, that we can keep it separate from employment. I know that with what I was doing last year, caring for my mother and also caring for my son, even if I had had a job with an insurance company, I would have lost my job. I couldn't have managed all of that at one point in time. And then what do you do? and my son, ready, willing, and able to work, but he'll probably have a few part-time jobs. And as we all know, they don't offer insurance. So I'm hoping also, though, that we'll find a way that will keep our insurance portable, fair, affordable, and with a national standard. Thank you.
Well, those are some excellent points. Thank you. Thank you. I mean, there are a couple points that I just want to highlight. We mentioned earlier the whole issue of pre-existing conditions, and that may come up repeatedly. This is something that has to be a central principle to significant health care reform. I mean, the notion that insurance companies won't pay if you're sick sort of defeats the purpose of insurance. Now, I recognize that, if somebody's chosen not to get insurance, then they, get in a car accident and then they said, okay, now I want to buy insurance, that the insurance company obviously would want to protect itself from those kinds of situations. But most of the time, all of us these days are going to be vulnerable to accusations of pre-existing conditions because of the Human Genome Project. Medicine is advancing so quickly that we are going to be able to predict to some degree some of the illnesses that we are going to be most vulnerable to. And if you've got an insurance system that can discriminate on that basis, we are really going to have a tough time managing a system in which ordinary people have coverage. Now, the second issue that you brought up is one that I want to raise more broadly, and that is the issue of portability. As I said, we've got 47 million uninsured. Many of them work. Many of them are in between jobs or part-time jobs or temporary jobs in which they don't get benefits. Now, one of the questions I guess I have is, actually, why don't I take a quick survey here? How many people have health insurance through their employer? Raise your hands. Okay. So the majority of people have health insurance through their employers. How many people have health insurance through some government program like Medicare or Medicaid? Okay. So that's a decent number. How many people right now have no coverage at all? Okay. And how many people have catastrophic coverage of the sort that we heard about earlier? So I guess the question I have is, for those who are getting health insurance through their employer, traditionally, I think many of you are aware, it's sort of a historical accident that we ended up with a employer-based healthcare system compared to other countries, because in other countries, it was an initiative of the state to set up a state-based healthcare system. What happened in this country was that initially, Blue Cross, a system formed back in the early 20s to help folks with, to help groups bring down some of their costs of medical care and get more regular care. And then during World War II, there were wage controls that were put in place by FDR. And what the FDR administration said to the employers was, look, since you can't raise wages, we're in a wartime situation, what you can do is provide more benefits. And so employers then used healthcare benefits as a tool to recruit more workers. After World War II, what then happened was is that we passed a system in which employers got tax breaks for providing health care benefits. So, it wasn't taxable to the employer, gave them a huge incentive to set up the system. So the system's just sort of evolved without anybody really thinking through its consequences. I guess the question now is, for those who have health insurance through the job, what's happening to you, and what are the aspects of insurance through the job that you prefer? What are the aspects that you don't like? And if you were presented with a plan, I'm sorry, what was your name again? Lori. Of the sort that Lori described, in which you had some sort of system that was no longer employer-based, how would you feel about that? Or at least what elements would you have to still have that would convince you to switch over? Anybody want to take a stab at that? Yeah. Well, go ahead. What's your name? Hold on.
My name's Nancy Beach. I live here in Portsmouth. I work for a, I guess you'd call it a micro enterprise. We have four employees. And I'm a divorced mother. I have two boys. One is a freshman at the University of New Hampshire. He currently is insured under Healthy Kids through the state of New Hampshire. I have a 22-year-old son with Down syndrome, who's a friend of Michael's. And he, again, forced onto Medicaid because I couldn't afford it. I went for 5 years with no insurance. And again, like the woman over here, I tried my best not to get sick. And if it wasn't for the complete and total generosity of my boss, who pays $700 a month for me to have insurance, I still would have no insurance. And what it means to me is that I don't make much money. My company can't really afford to pay my health insurance, but they do because of the generosity of my boss. If anything were to happen to this little tiny company, I wouldn't have insurance again. I know people who couldn't get a divorce because their wife or soon ex-wife had breast cancer. So what was this person supposed to do? Cut her off? Whereas if it didn't follow, if insurance was with us, I mean, people use the term accessibility. We want all Americans to have accessible health care. We want them to be accessible. Well, we all basically have access to health care. We just can't afford it. I think the rhetoric needs to change. We need to be provided health care. When we went into Afghanistan and Iraq, nobody questioned where we were going to get the money to fund it. So when people say to me, well, what do you mean you want single-payer universal health care that will follow you from wherever you go, whatever job you have, the first thing they say is, where are you going to get the money to, where are you going to pay it? Well, where are we get the money? Where are we getting the billions, the hundred billions of dollars to stay in Iraq? And isn't it worth it for this country to have healthy citizens? You talked about FDR, and he created an economic bill of rights that he never got to put forward because he died. And under that, it was, you know, a living wage, enough money so that people could afford a roof over their head, food in their belly, a decent job, and health care. And I would ask you, are you willing to go forward and help us so that we have a healthy country again?
Well, you make a powerful statement. First of all, the way we funded the war in Iraq was to borrow it from China. We put it on our credit card. We're going to have those bills to pay, but that's didn't mean to editorialize. It's just an example of bad budgeting at the federal level. But look, you make a powerful point. And by the way, one of the concerns I have about your employer, who sounds like a wonderful person and is willing to step up on behalf of his or her employees, is that if one of you gets sick, then your premiums, the premiums that your employer will have to pay may shoot up astronomically overnight. And so suddenly, in fact, not she may not be able to afford everybody. And that's one of the biggest problems with small employers is, I know I wasn't going to use the word pool, but because it's such a small pool, they're very vulnerable to huge gyrations in premiums as a consequence of one person getting sick. Is there somebody who's got stable, regular health insurance that wants to talk a little bit about the stories that you've heard? Young lady back there, and then I'll go up right in front. Go ahead.
Hi, my name is Leslie Parker. I'm actually here as a representative of a small company, and that was my concern when the day before I saw that this event was going to be happening. Our little company got our renewal notice for this next year. And our rates have gone up 22%, more than 22% for next year. This has happened every single year since 1994 at that kind of rate. You can just see our dilemma. We are a small company. We have 10 employees. We intend and want to provide the best health care coverage.
Do you work there or you're an
owner? I do.
Are you
an
owner?
I'm the CFO.
You're the CFO, so you're...
My husband's an owner.
You guys are tracking the books.
We are. I'm the CFO, and I do all that stuff. And I'm the one that's essentially the decider of what we...
Oh, well, you've got the same arrangement as my household.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's my job in the company. As to what, and we want, I mean, we want to run an ethical, moral, good company, and we have wonderful employees, and it's our every intention. And we personally want, really, I have a chronic illness, and we personally want the best health care coverage that we can get. It is, everything that these people have said is absolutely true. And speaking as an employer, from our standpoint, I don't really know now what we're going to do, because the plan that we're offered, that's the equivalent plan, is actually a worse plan than what we had last year. And last year's plan is a worse plan. They don't even offer the current plan.
So you're saying the degree of coverage and benefits that are offered have gotten worse at the same time as the costs have gone up 22%.
Exactly.
I'm just curious, without meddling too much in your business, what does that represent in terms of your profit margin? I mean, do you have a...
I don't know if I'll tell you that. He's going to choke, but I will tell you.
But I guess my assumption is a lot of small businesses are operating on relatively small margins.
I can tell you dollars.
Yeah.
This increase would mean $16,500. To right. our company for 10 people. Now we would pay next year over $100,000 in health care insurance.
I'm sorry, let's run that.
That's 10 people.
10
and
people
their
time,
families.
Times 16,000.
Because their families are included.
Right.
And it would be $100,000 we would be paying over that.
Right.
But now we're in the process now. Year after year, this has gone on, and now we're at a place where it's a struggle.
So what are you
reevaluating? What
are you thinking about doing? Maybe pulling back and offering catastrophic care?
No, we're not going to do that at all. I'm actually really looking into HSAs and funding it for employees, because I think we can save some money there. We want to fund it for our employees. We don't want. I mean,
for everybody who's not familiar, HSAs are health savings account. Which was what the strategy that George Bush promoted as a way of dealing with health care. Just keep in mind, though, if I'm not mistaken, that if you put money in HSAs, your employees are then going to have to go and find insurance, and they're going to be
probably in
a similar position here? Or is there some other system that you've found?
There is. Through our insurer, we can set up an HSA.
I see. So
if they're complicated, I don't want to have to do this.
Okay.
I'm trying to make it the simplest thing that I can for our company.
Right.
But, you know, recognize that this is a huge problem.
What would you like to see if you were advising the president, what would be a system that, from the employer's perspective, would make sense? If I said to you, you have to pay a certain amount in taxes, for example, because one of the proposals, Ron Wyden, one of my colleagues in the Senate, has proposed a system where you lose your tax deduction for providing health care. Your employees then are going to get health care on their own. But there's got to be a system in which employers are going to have to pay money into the system in order to subsidize care for individuals. Would that be a simpler system, one that you prefer? It would then be portable.
It would, but I guess one question I have is that for small businesses that are entrepreneurial in nature, I mean, we're sort of the nursery for bigger businesses down the road. And we need to spend our money really on developing our products and getting our products out to market. And having to spend it all on healthcare really prevents company growth in a way, if you can follow the... So I think that what I would like to see is just some sort of a break for new young businesses in a way, or making it more economical for us to be able to buy into the system.
Okay, great. So,
and I like her ideas very much.
Good. This gentleman right here, right in front of you. Please introduce yourself.
I'm Richard Friedman. Actually, I'm fortunate. I'm a physician in the state, but I've been in private practice and paid the premiums. But now I'm insured through my wife, who works for the state of New Hampshire, which is a stable premium system. The question that was asked was, where would we get the money from? And the point I think that I wanted to make is that we've looked at access, we've looked at the finances, we haven't looked at how we use the money. And you touched upon it before, that we spend an awful lot with not a lot of return. And there's good data that suggests that 30% of what we spend really doesn't help people. So there is a lot of money out there if we could find the way to make people accountable. And people means our insurers who are spending money on our behalf, the physicians, and also all the people, the consumers of the country.
Well, as somebody who's been inside the system as a physician, where do you see the most waste in the system? You know, if you could rationalize the system, where would you start?
The most waste, basically, at this point, relates to the fact that we don't have an IT system, so that information is not available to doctors. Second is the overuse of testing, overuse of therapy, which is of no benefit. And probably the third waste has to do with the extraordinary cost of medication. We pay more in this country than the rest of the world. Doesn't
prescription
make sense.
Drugs.
Prescription drugs.
Right. The and just you know, how many people here have taken advantage of Medicare Part D? I'll take a survey in a bit in terms of your satisfaction levels on it, but obviously we initiated the prescription drug benefit under Medicare, but the Congress, I wasn't there at the time, and neither was Carol, so we can't take credit for this mistake. The decision was made not to allow Medicare to negotiate with drug manufacturers in the same way that the VA system negotiates on behalf of drug manufacturers. As a consequence, even those who are participating in Medicare Part D, the system, or directly or indirectly, those who are participating, pay way more than anybody who's participating in the VA system for the exact same drug. Now, if you take Zocar, you're paying about 10 times what those in the VA system pay, just because the VA system was allowed, there was a carve-out that allowed them to negotiate for prescription drugs, and the Medicare benefit, we decided, wouldn't do it. That obviously is an enormous mistake, and maybe we can touch on that. But before we leave this topic, though, I'm looking for somebody who's... Is there anybody here who's got health care from the job, and they're really satisfied with it, and they don't want to give it up, or at least there are elements of it that they don't want to give up? I want to, that's the person I'm looking for. I'm looking for somebody who's got good health insurance on the job and are relatively happy with it. What's your name? Hold on, let's bring this mic up. Oh, and the reason I'm asking the question in this way is Lori made a very powerful point, which was echoed by Nancy, which indicated at least a impulse to move towards a portable system that might be a single-payer system of the sort that exists in other countries. And you know, when you do surveys, it turns out that a lot of people who've got health insurance are suspicious of moving away from the employer-based system, partly just out of habit, you know, you're comfortable with what you got. Partly there's a concern that you will lose choice of doctor, or you will lose flexibility in the plan or the system. And that choice of doctor seems to be very important to people. So I just want to dig a little bit deeper, because if this group is representative of the country, then one of the things that I want to find out is whether folks are actually ready to move off an employer-based system. This is how you get into trouble when you're president. You start saying, we're going full speed ahead, and you look behind, and nobody's behind you. And so I want to find out what people are thinking who've got health care on the job. Go ahead.
Well, I have to tell you that my name is Megan Lockwood, by the way, and I did have great health care on the job, and I've had several different kinds of health care, so I can tell you the worst thing that can happen from having great health care.
Okay.
But, you know, to answer the first question, I think that the benefit of having something like what I had, I worked for Merrill Lynch, for example, what I had at Merrill, 3 or 4 different choices, $500 deductible. It was a little more expensive per month, but then I'm single, so it wasn't, you know,
too burdensome.
Somewhere around $400 or $350 a month. So it was burdensome, but not to the point where I couldn't afford it. And I think that the benefit of having the choice between an HMO or a PPO, particularly for me, or also, you know, I'm an athlete, and so I have a tendency to end up in the emergency room from
What are you, a rugby player? Or?
I was a track runner in college, but okay. I played men's league soccer for a while after college. And actually, I was in a group plan for a while in my first job, and they kind of tried to talk me out of playing in the men's soccer because I would come in crutches or something because I didn't realize I was that small.
Yeah, you're not huge.
You're costing us way too much money. But, you know, I think the choice between whether or not I'm willing to spend $500 deductible to go to the emergency room or $250 deductible to go to the emergency room, and, you know, there are a lot of people that don't get, you know, are relatively healthy and don't get sick very often. And so, you know, they can choose to have a higher deductible, you know, and I'm saying, I mean, $10,000 is insane. But, you know, a slightly higher deductible for a lower cost. Mm-hmm. At the time, this was probably 4 years ago, it made sense. You know, I wanted a PPO. I wanted to be able to pick my doctors. I didn't want to have to go back to a primary care physician every single time I needed to see a new specialist or wanted to see a different doctor.
Right.
It was worth paying a little bit more to me.
Mm-hmm.
Now, having said that, I had that kind of coverage, and I still lost my house.
How'd that happen?
So, well, you know, 3 years ago, I was perfectly healthy, you know, working for a mutual fund, you know, consultancy in Boston, doing very well. I got a phantom pain in my stomach. Doctors can't find it. Still can't find it today. I've been through, we were counting it, I think I've seen 18 different doctors. I've been hospitalized for 3.5 weeks from at different points in time. I've had tests you wouldn't want to imagine or count, and I'm on 9 different medications. And, you know, I'm smart, and I lost, and I've been on, you know, Cobra of some kind for at least 12 months because I lost my job because I was sick. You know, I graduated from an Ivy League school. I, you know, I'm ambitious. I want to work. But at the point that I'm at now, you know, I lost my house. I'm basically bankrupt. I haven't officially called it yet. But, you know, it's at that point because nobody can find what to do.
So in retrospect then, knowing what you know now, having gone through what you've gone through, does that make you think that you'd rather have more of a safety net if you lose your job and you would be willing to exchange some of the flexibility of your employer-based plan, or do you still think to yourself, well, you should still be able to get an employer-based plan, but there should be also alternatives outside of the employer-based system?
I don't care if it's employer-based or not. In fact, I would prefer that it wasn't, because then those that don't have an employer are working part-time.
Or who are in between jobs.
You know, or in between jobs. It's not that part of the system that I care about at all. I think the specifics of the system that are valuable are, one, having a choice, and two, you know, not 15 different choices, or, you know, 17, or how many number of drug companies that are out there, but 4 or 5 that are reasonable, rational, well spelled out so that people understand it. And it's not, you know, you know, subsection B of, you know, really, you know.
I hear you. Yeah.
That says, oh, well, you can't actually take that, you know, you can't have that test unless it's, you know, approved by 18 doctors and, you know.
Right.
But I think that the larger problem that, you know, that I see is that it's public companies and they're serving two constituencies. They're serving us, trying to make us better, you know, insurance companies, health insurance companies, or health conglomerates, whatever you want to call them. But they're also really serving their stockholders. And I don't think that it's a surprise that, you know, most analysts that I've been watching on and off, but especially this summer, said healthcare, you know, is the sector to buy because they've been made money end over end over the last several years, while, you know, everyone else is doesn't have the money to pay, and it's become cost prohibitive to have health insurance. So, you know, if you have two constituencies, you're going to serve the stockholder because those are the people that are paying. Those are the people that are paying your paycheck.
Okay, good. Well, thank you. Thank you for your story. I hope it worked. I hope it works. It works out. What the gentleman back here? Is anybody going to come to the defense of the employer-based system and the status quo? Well, let's see. I'm still searching.
You sure? All right. I'm Art Hilson from Portsmouth, and I work two full-time jobs. Both have health care programs. I don't take either one. That's not bad.
Hold on. You work two full-time? When are you sleeping?
Between 2 and 5 in the morning.
Wow.
But I do have insurance.
Okay.
Retired military, University of Mass, retired, Medicare. The issue with me is that we have three children with college bills. Last year, I came down with prostate cancer. And for 2 months, every day, I was in the center getting chemotherapy and radiation every day for 2 months. I thank God that I had coverage. Had I not, my choice was, do I educate my children or do I die from the cancer? Because I had stable insurance, I wondered, what about those who don't? It's a reality that black men, I am black, you can tell that, I think. Black men do get prostate cancer. My father died of prostate cancer. My mother died of cancer. My sister has breast cancer. And so it's about surviving. I looked at the bills that came in. The bills that came in for every day, a bill for every visit, almost $1,000. That's just one physician. When I look at all of them, it was a bill that would be somewhere around $50,000. What about those who don't have coverage? What do they do? Do they die for lack of care, or do they what? And so I would say that for those who don't have that, we do pay taxes. I feel that the government has a responsibility. That I heard someone say a minute ago, when you can find $80 billion like that to kill people, you ought to be able to find some money to let people live.
Well, thank you. Thank you. One thing I just want to point out, you mentioned the high incidence of prostate cancer among African Americans. You know, one of the problems that African Americans and Latinos both have is they are less likely to get preventive care, which means that when they are diagnosed with treatable cancers, oftentimes they are so far advanced that they can no longer be cured. And it's part of the reason why preventive care is so critical. You know, prostate cancer is something that if you catch quickly enough, can be cured, and then you look pretty good, I got to say. But the problem is a lot of folks aren't able to get regular mammograms, aren't getting regular prostate exams, aren't getting colonoscopies. There's a set of preventative steps that can be taken that would save the system as a whole money, and we've got to start figuring out how we're going to shift more money into that area. Yes, please go ahead.
That now, because of my, and I'll be 71 years old in 3 days, and so when I want to increase insurance for my wife who's 15 years younger and 3 children, I'm no longer able to get any insurance because I had cancer.
Right. Good. Did you still want to make a point? You had your hand up. Since you had your hand up at the same time.
My name is Jane Weller, and it feels like we're not talking about the elephant in the room, which is the HMOs and the pharmacy houses. 60 Minutes had a program this week on what happened in Congress when the pharmacies wrote the bill and wouldn't let the vote pass until they had all the votes they wanted. We feel very cynical about the government. What we really need is a single-payer service. We don't need HMOs feeding at the trough of our money. The paper this week, the Sunday Times, had an article on an idea of having...
Yeah, that was Ron Wyden's bill that I just mentioned earlier.
Right.
Yeah.
And this would mean we would continue to have HMOs. We would still have these elaborate administrative costs, and we would be paying far more than we really have to.
Right. Is there anybody here who, you probably won't admit it at this point, anybody here who works for an insurance company or a drug company? Do you work for an insurance company or a drug company? Well, let's get this story just real quickly. You say that you worked for an insurance company?
Yes, I worked for the ING company.
Which is a health insurance company?
Yes.
And they let you go. How come?
I had a stroke, and they let me go the next day.
Well, that's not good. No. Were you insured by them?
Yes. I was insured by the Bank of America. I'm a retired banker, and I, through the result of 6 bank mergers, I ended up with the Bank of America. Now I get health insurance from the Bank of America, but I'm going to run out of it next year because they take it out of what I get for an income.
They fired you the next day.
Yes. My wife was with me at the meeting.
And what did they say? What was their rationale? Tough luck.
They just said he was fired. If they didn't fire him, they have to lay 3 people off.
I see.
Well, that was his choice.
Let me then play devil's advocate, just because I want to push everybody on this. Let's say that I proposed a plan that moved to a single-payer system. Let's say Medicare Plus. Essentially, everybody can buy into Medicare, for example. It would cost a huge amount of money on the part of the government. So we would have to, first of all, take away... This isn't the only way to do it, but I'm just giving this as an example. Let's say that I said to all employers, you no longer get a tax deduction for giving health care to your employees. And so that gives us several $100 billion. And we are now in a system in which everybody's buying into Medicare. The insurance companies and the drug companies would argue that that is going to result in rationing because... the costs are going to be sufficiently great that people are going to have to wait for services instead of getting them right at the time that they get them. at the time that they need them. Drug companies would argue that if they have to negotiate with Medicare for all the drugs that people need, that they're not going to have any money for research and development, that the profit system and the market-based healthcare system is what produces all the innovation in our healthcare system, which is why, at least for those who can afford care, hospitals and doctors in the United States are as good as anywhere in the nation. And so, and by the way, to pay for all this, in addition to taking away the employer deduction, we probably have to raise everybody's taxes a fairly significant amount. What about those arguments? Go ahead. This young lady right here.
Hi, my name is Leslie Brenner, and I'm the proud daughter of Sandra Brenner, who lives in Long Island, New York, who's been working on healthcare reform in her area for a long time and kind of educated me. But
speak up a little.
I think that, as this gentleman over here, Mr. Hilson, was saying, it seems to be more of a values issue to me than anything else. I mean, how many years have we been talking about this? I remember about 16 years ago when my daughter was one, standing in a public forum for a political candidate asking a question about healthcare reform. And there are many, many intelligent, articulate, passionate people that keep discussing this for years. And you don't need to hear more about people's individual problems. I'm sure you've heard them all. I'm sure they've been talked about in so many cities and so many communities for years. And I think it comes down to, does our country have values about having equity in people's lives? When I go to the doctor or get a medical test for myself or my children, and I pay a $20 copay at the doctor, or I have a medical exam, I always think of those people that cannot do that, that have to make hard choices about whether they pay the bill for that or don't go at all. And so their life is no less valuable than mine. And I think that we just don't care enough as a country to make this hard choice. It's the profits, the profits, the profits. And I am very skeptical that with you in office or anybody in office, this is going to change because there's such a strong lobby out there. And how many more years can we talk about the broken system?
Although the lobby shouldn't be stronger than the people. I mean, the one thing I'll say about government. And I've now been in elected office for over 10 years, is lobbyists have a disproportionate influence because of access and because the particular provision in a piece of legislation that's really important to their employer is not so important to everybody else. And so they will fight tooth and nail for years on that one provision, whereas everybody else knows that it's contrary to the public interest, but they're not doing it full time, and they can't hire a lobbyist to look out for their interests.
That's what we elect our public officials don't we?
Well, that should be what we do. But here's the point I was going to make, though, is that what public officials, I find, people talk about money corrupting politics. Actually, the thing that's most corrupting about politics is politicians being afraid to lose. And the reason that they get all that money is because they think somehow that protects them and ensures that they'll get reelected. It's very rare where Duke Cunningham types, are taking money to buy boats. It happens, but that's not the norm. They take money from lobbyists because they think it'll help them get elected or keep their seat. If there are enough voters paying attention where they've got a different calculus and they know, if I do X, I will be punished at the polls, then they're less likely to listen to the lobbyist. And so I guess my point is, and this is a little bit of an aside, but I don't want people to lose confidence about the capacity to change how government operates. If in a congressional district, if you have 1,000 people or a couple of thousand people writing letters. I promise you that congressman or woman pays a lot of attention. They really do. Now, of course, you've got to have 1,000, 2,000 people writing letters in every congressional district, or at least in a majority of congressional districts, in order to actually implement policy. I don't want you to lose hope, I guess is what I'm saying.
I'm just frustrated because hearing people's personal stories doesn't seem like it's anything new. And I appreciate the fact that this forum is here and that you're interested in getting feedback from people on what they feel will fix the problem. So that's a good thing. Yeah. And we should continue to have those discussions, but it just seems kind of frustrating that we're still having them after all these years.
What I'm trying to figure out more than, obviously the personal stories are important, but you're right. I don't need to know that people are suffering. As I said, I saw with my mother, you know, my daughter had asthma when she was young, and one time she had to go to the emergency room, and during the time that I was there in the emergency room with her, I discovered children who go to the emergency room every week because they don't have regular checkups. And, you know, so some of these stories I've heard, I guess that's why what I'm really looking for is a sense of, you talk about values, what is it about the status quo for voters that they want to protect or preserve that prevents this, you know, movement from happening to move it in a different direction? And some of it is lobbyists, and some of it is, you know, special interests. But some of it is also, you know, when Harry and Louise ads were run in 1994, you could watch the polling, and a whole bunch of people suddenly said, "Oh, I don't want to lose my choice of doctors, and I don't want some bureaucrat in my, you know, medicine cabinet." And you know, so part of what I'm trying to get a sense is, what is it that people value in the existing system so that whatever plan we put together, we can mobilize as a group and make it happen? Do you have any ideas on that?
Yes. I think in some ways there's been kind of a secret kept from the American people, and it keeps coming back. It seems to me what's so obvious about listening to everybody today is that what all these stories add up to is that the kind of system we have is actually rationing our health care, is actually rationing who lives and dies, is actually rationing who has to go through financial ruin instead of getting the kind of care that they need to get. That this is a consequence of a for-profit health care system. And when you're talking about for-profit, that for-profit is, you're paying the middleman. You're paying the middleman for what should be just between the patient and the system and whoever's paying the system. But you hear people get worried about rationing if they don't have employer-based insurance, which I don't understand because we have the rationing. It's not explicit. But it's there all the time. The Institute of Medicine estimates that at least 18,000 Americans a year die because they have no insurance. And then they're all, you know, 170 million people at least in America are on HMOs. HMOs, they don't have a choice of which doctor they go to. I don't understand. You ask somebody, well, you know, people don't want to lose their choice of doctors. Well, I mean, it is true. There are those who have very high-quality medical care can choose their doctors and who have the power to pay. But they're a very small percentage of Americans. Those 170 million people on HMOs can't choose which doctor they go to. My in-laws who lived in Chicago were in an HMO. They could never choose which doctor. And then even the U.S. Supreme Court, they ruled in 2004 that we cannot sue an HMO if our doctor rules that we need something and the HMO decides that we that they're not going to pay for it. There is nothing that can be done. That is rationing. And a single-payer system
would not have anywhere near that amount of rationing.
You've had your hand up for a while, so yes, young lady right there, yeah. Let's get the mic. But before you start, let me just say this, because we've probably got about 10 or 15 more minutes. And I've heard some powerful statements here, so it's really been extraordinarily helpful. A couple of things that we haven't touched on that I'd love to hear from people about. Again, if you can tell me sort of the aspects of the system, the way Lori did, the aspects of the system that you'd like to see. You know, what is it that you value, whether it's in the existing system or in whatever new system would be set up? That's something that I would like to hear. Because that will be helpful to us. The second thing that I'd like to talk about a little bit is prevention. We heard from a couple of people who have high deductibles that they can't afford to get sick, and so they really keep themselves in good shape and so forth. On the other hand, as a country, we are generally very unhealthy, and we spend, again, 5 cents out of every healthcare dollar is spent on prevention. The other 95% is not really healthcare, it's disease care. It's after people already get sick, we then treat them. And so I'm interested in what people think would change behavior, quit smoking, lose weight, get exercise, get regular checkups. What in your experience makes a difference in terms of encouraging more money going into prevention? That's the second thing that I want to hear about. And the third thing that I'm interested in as we close up is tell me some experiences you've had in terms of the healthcare bureaucracy, if you do have health insurance, negotiating it, because we've already heard we could make an enormous amount of progress just implementing medical technology in the healthcare system. And I'm just wondering if people have ideas as to what are the most frustrating aspects of the system, even if you do have health insurance. So go ahead.
I don't have any of those.
That's okay. I still called on you, but I just wanted to. We've got about 15 minutes. And by the way, I failed to say that I've got two people, Mark Alexander and Lisa Ellman, who've been taking copious notes during this whole process. So in addition to this being video streamed and it'll be up on our website, we're also, these are two of my folks who work in my policy shop. They're actually listening to this stuff and are going to be incorporating it into the plan that we put together. So if you saw me not taking notes, it wasn't because we don't have somebody taking notes. Go ahead.
First of all, I so appreciate your being here. I'm Luann Thomas. I live in Kittery, Maine. I am a senior, but I'm not going to tell you my story. I'm going to be the voice for those people that Mr. Hilson is questioning. I work with a domestic violence agency, Caring Unlimited, in York County. We cover York County. People stay in unsafe homes. People get murdered. Kids get beaten because they are afraid if they leave the home, they will not be able to afford insurance. They can't make it on their own. And it's a real dilemma for our clients and their children.
Well, somebody mentioned the inability to get divorced as a consequence of, not wanting to leave somebody in the lurch because they didn't have health insurance. I mean, the notion, obviously, is there anybody here who's ever decided not to leave a job because they couldn't afford to be left without health insurance? I mean, there's some people. Well, there you go. So so that's obviously something.
Or would you stay in an unsafe home?
It's a similar kind of circumstance. So that is one of the arguments for setting up a portable system. Gentleman right here next to you had a point. Introduce yourself, please.
My name is Jason Haberman. I live in Georgia at the moment. I'm here visiting my family. But a couple of things I'd like to see. I'm the father of three daughters, and currently I'm uninsured. I was an affiliate of the IBEW, the Electrical Brotherhood, the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, and I had great insurance. 100% coverage, no copay, no nothing. It's a great system. Unfortunately, there are layoffs, and you go through times where you can't swing it, so you're put on COBRA, and then your payments go somewhere near $1,000 a month for your family, which in this day and age is darn near impossible to cover. I'd like to see a lot more affordability for families who are struggling, who are just below the crust of, you know, middle class, which is probably the largest percent in the country. I'd like to see dental care, eye care, things that just are, you know, my daughters are all going to need braces, and I question how I'm going to afford that. My big concern is we talk about changing the healthcare system. The other question is, can we afford it? You know, there's all this talk, the underbelly of like, you know, mortgaging ourselves to the nth degree. And I'm curious on how, if we are able to implement a healthcare system, how we're going to pay for it.
Well, two points that you made that are very important. One, dental care, eye care, particularly for children, is absolutely critical. It impacts how they perform in school. If they're undiagnosed and they have vision problems or serious tooth decay, that can impact profoundly how they perform in school and affect their overall health over the long term. One of the few success stories we've had in our healthcare system is actually the SCHIP program. I think here it's called Healthy Kids here in New Hampshire. That is up for reauthorization, and we're going to have to come up with at least $15 billion in new money just to maintain the existing coverage that's provided to kids through the SCHIP program. There are an additional 6 million, I believe, children who are not covered, but who would otherwise be eligible. So we'd have to come up with some additional money to cover them, to make sure that every child has basic coverage. And I think it raises then the issue of cost. And that's why there have been a couple times where I've pushed people on the idea of paying higher taxes in order to implement the system. Now, keep in mind, we've said that we're spending $2 trillion. Obviously, a lot of that money is being wasted and is not going to direct care. Estimates range from 20% to 30% of our healthcare dollars go into red tape, paperwork, profits for, you know, the private marketplace, and so forth. Conceivably, it is possible to capture those savings and apply them to provide coverage, in theory. But transitioning a system is a very difficult and costly and lengthy enterprise. It's not like you can turn on a switch and you go from one system to another. So it's possible that up front you would need not just, I mean, you might need an additional $90 or $100 billion a year to provide coverage, with the understanding that you would capture savings over the long term as the system transitioned. And you know, the question then becomes, how do people feel about paying additional money? And also, how do people feel about putting more money into a system that's so inefficient right now that it's possible that you're just wasting more money? So anybody have any thoughts on that? Go ahead.
Hi, my name is Linda Barron, and I'm from Greenland. I work.
You're from where?
Greenland, New Hampshire.
Okay.
And
I haven't been to Greenland yet, so I was thinking, wow, you know,
yeah.
You really came for a long way for this healthcare reform. Okay, go ahead.
And I feel kind of caught in the middle. I'm a healthcare provider, and I work as a nurse anesthetist at a local hospital. Mm-hmm. 40% of our patients that we see every day are somehow state-aided in their healthcare insurance. I myself am very lucky that the group that I belong to, we have about 200 practitioners in our group. So my health care is excellent, and I'm very lucky that I have a great PPO. We pay our copay, and we pay in for our insurance, but we're lucky that we can take it out of our pay before taxes, so it doesn't hurt us. which is a definite benefit, are the plans that you're talking about taking away the tax credit for businesses? Are you talking about applying that to private citizens and so that they are motivated to buy into this system that you're talking about? And also on the flip side, being a healthcare provider, I see that Medicare, Medicaid pays 62 cents on the dollar, whereas some of the HMOs that we deal with are paying 80 cents on the dollar. How do we compensate the healthcare providers that we have and actually motivate young people to go into healthcare? Because right now you're looking at a mortgage payment every month to pay your student loans as a healthcare provider.
Well, you've made a bunch of important points. There are a range of variations that have been proposed if you shifted towards a new, more portable system. For example, Ron Wyden's plan would say that you as an individual now have to buy insurance. Your company would have to give you an increase in wages that was comparable to the cost of your previous health care benefit if you were previously getting health care, that you would then apply to buying your health insurance. And there would be incentives and tax breaks for you to get preventative care to encourage a more healthy lifestyle. Other plans have proposed different approaches to the issue. You're right that Medicare and Medicaid, oftentimes politicians use those two systems as a way of, as a sort of a safety valve in the budget, particularly at the state level. So what they do is if they get in a budget crunch, they will delay payments to doctors or the reimbursements won't be quite as high and force providers to suck up the costs. It presents a problem, particularly because Medicare and Medicaid, well, Medicare is going to soon be, if it is not already, broke and is probably the biggest fiscal crisis that we have on the horizon. At the state level, Medicaid is the second largest expenditure after public education. And so both are putting enormous strains on federal budgets. That's why I say we would have to find new sources of revenue, at least in the transition process, to move towards the kinds of systems that you're talking about. Did you have a point here? One last thing that I wanted to point out. Thank you for being a nurse. Nurses are underappreciated and underpaid. And one of the things that you were talking about getting young people to get into the medical profession, we have a chronic nurse shortage all across the country because of the fact not only are nurses underpaid, but in a lot of large hospitals and medical systems, nurses are increasingly being asked to carry a much higher load, work more overtime, care for more patients on their floor. If we don't provide some relief to the nursing profession, we are going to continue to have problems filling that important gap in the healthcare system. Go
ahead. Hi, my name is Rob Slocum. I'm a family physician at the local community health center. And we serve approximately 50% of our patient population as uninsured, and that number is growing. But I just wanted to, my question to you was, and this is, you know, along the lines of prevention as well, you know, would you be willing to sit down with public health officials in like other countries like Canada and Europe to discuss how their system works? Because their system has preventative measures built into it. For example, paying women to for maternity leave so that they can at least stay home and try to breastfeed their children. And that's where prevention starts, you know, in the first year of life. So I just was wondering if that's something you thought about.
Well, we are definitely talking to experts, not just here in the United States, but in other countries that are doing certain things more effectively than we are. As I said, I'm agnostic. I want to get good ideas from all sources, and I'm not predisposed to a certain way of doing things. If somebody's doing something better, we should try it. Yes, sir.
Sorry, I'm Tom Claremont. I'm an internist in Portsmouth, been practicing here for 29 years. I'm a member of Physicians for a National Health Program. Our program solves all of these issues. We want comprehensive coverage. We want universal coverage for everyone. We want no copays, no deductibles, and particularly we want no pre-existing conditions. I reviewed your comments from Las Vegas, and you know we're in agreement on most of the issues that we've discussed here today. You said you want everybody to put something into the system. We think that if you continue with federal money, 8% employer tax, because 41% of businesses, including Walmart, do not supply insurance to their employees. Now we want them to jump into the system, and then 3% from employees or anybody else, 3% of their income, would cover it all. There's a lot of waste in the system. A lot of it goes for marketing, denying care, people harassing me in practice every day. We don't need any of these people. So I think everybody should really look at the Physicians for a National Health Program, PNHP.org. It really is an excellent program. It actually passed California last year. Governor Schwarzenegger vetoed it, called it socialized medicine. It's not socialized medicine. And the House of Representatives in New Hampshire just passed last week the bill on Medicare for All. So the state of New Hampshire is on record saying we want to change. We think this type of a program, which covers everyone, is the proper way to go. So I'm hoping you'll have time,
we'll make time.
To look at that
system. Thank you very much for being here. Thank you. Gentleman back here. Oh, I'm sorry. There's somebody behind here. I'm sorry. See, I was getting comfortable in my seat. Since I already called on this gentleman, let's go here, and then we'll hit both guys with the beards. All right.
Hi, Senator Obama. Thanks for being here today. I work for an employer that actually prides themselves on benefits, and I've actually had the distinct honor of working with privilege of working with Nancy's son, Nate, a great guy. I guess what my concern would be in moving forward with national health care, I'm happy with the insurance coverage that I have right now. And I guess I'd be concerned about pulling it out of the employer's hands and seeing a degradation in the quality of service. I think that you have a tremendous uphill battle providing national health care, but on the same note, you're still going to be faced with even greater challenge of promoting the healthcare industry into additional research and development, and continuing the quality of service that we have now.
Sure. But what I'm just curious. You're happy with your healthcare. I finally found somebody who fessed up. Have you the one thing that has been happening, even for people who have pretty high quality employer-based healthcare, is they've increasingly seen their premiums, their copayments, and deductibles going up. I'm wondering if that's happened to you. Have you started, your employer started to have conversations about maybe we need you to get more skin in the game, we need you to pay a little bit more and be a better healthcare consumer, or are you starting to hear some of those things on your job?
Absolutely. We've seen that a little bit. We actually just transitioned from one healthcare provider to another one this past January. The provider that we were with prior to that, we'd been with for several years. So we've seen a slight increase in premiums, a little bit difference in coverage. I've received a few letters from the healthcare provider that we have now saying that, this is changing, that's changing, and it's a big inconvenience. So, yes, I do see that trend. But the fact that I do have a decent provider right now, I am happy with that.
I guess the question is there a point in time where you finally say, man, I just can't, I'm not as happy. And I'll just give you a statistic. The costs of healthcare for families who have insurance have gone up 4 times faster than wages and benefits. 87% increases over the last several years. And it's conceivable that a lot more employers who are finding themselves in a more competitive environment, particularly when companies like Walmart, for example, aren't really providing health insurance, and other companies like Costco are trying to compete with them and providing health insurance, they're finding themselves under a lot of pressure and pushing more of the costs onto their employees. That's one of the reasons why, for example, why unions these days, if you talk to any union, I don't care what the industry is, you ask them, what are you spending all your time negotiating on? They'll tell you, well, we don't even try to negotiate for higher wages these days. I mean, everything is all about trying to maintain the health care benefits that we have. And so I'm wondering, are you confident enough in our ability to sustain this system? At what point do you kind of jump off and say, all right, this is getting real bad and I need to actually...
I do believe that our company is beginning to feel that squeeze. Otherwise, we wouldn't have made the transition just this past January.
Right.
I think, you know, it's something that as we grow larger as a company, we're going to continue to see, and it's going to become more cost prohibitive to provide quality coverage for our employees. But, again, my concern is, you know, I don't want to see the degradation in the quality of service.
What are the parts that, of the healthcare system that you like? That if we were to offer you a different kind of system, what would be the key things that you'd want to keep?
One of the things that I really like about the coverage I have now is I have the flexibility to choose my providers, the doctors I want to see. I don't want to be forced into, okay, this is the doctor that you have to see for this particular ailment. This is a doctor you have to see for this ailment. I do like that that freedom that I have.
Good. Okay, I promise this gentleman right here.
My name's Gary Dozier from Hampton Falls. My wife and I have been retired for about the past 5 years, but I've gone back to grad school to get a master's degree in education so I can go out and teach and pay the medical bills that we're in the midst of and will have as we grow older.
Are you qualifying for Medicare already?
No. Okay. No. But I have two thoughts, not panaceas, but two thoughts. They've been in existence for quite a while, but one of them is in the area of flash keys, little key fobs that would end up storing individuals' medical records. Now, I know you've been instrumental in the medical information technology bill, but I want to emphasize that for the cost of those keys that can be secured, people could simply go to their primary care physician, their hospital, whatever healthcare provider, give them the key fob, let them download what's needed, and process it without taking 20 minutes, an hour, 2 hours to document all of their records, and they would carry their records with them. I think that's an important thing because we need to protect those records, and we've learned that sometimes the records are modified incorrectly, and prescriptions as well. The second point is on a grander scale. This nation pays about $30 billion to maintain 10,000 nuclear weapons. If we could shift a little, diminish that number of 10,000 down to 1,000, we could end up moving considerable amounts to health, education, welfare, and a variety of other things.
Do you have one of those pens from Ben Cohen?
I do indeed.
I figured as much. I've been collecting those pens. It actually is a pen that has a chart talking about spending priorities. I don't want to focus on the whole issue of the Pentagon budget because that would take us into a whole other forum. But I appreciate your point about medical technology. Not only would it save money, but it would drastically reduce medical error. And people, I think, don't realize that about 98,000 people every year are dying as a consequence of medical error. Now, you're never going to get zero medical error because it's a human enterprise. But preventable medical errors could save lives and save money and reduce malpractice insurance for providers. And one of the best ways of doing it is if you've got medical records that are there, easily retrievable, that makes a huge difference in terms of the overarching system. Now, and by the way, that's an area where we should be willing to make an investment up front because there may be community hospitals in rural areas, for example, that can't afford to set up computerization and the software system. The federal government should subsidize that initial process and to say to those who are billing the federal government, if you aren't setting up this electronic system, then we are going to not allow you to participate in the program. And I promise you, providers and insurers and so forth will jump on that bandwagon pretty quickly. Here's the problem, guys. I'm out of time. We went a little bit over because everybody's participation was so terrific. So I'm going to have to cut it off here. But what I want to talk about is follow-up and how we're going to follow up in this process. We are going to take this community meeting. I'm going to have one in Iowa this week as well. And we're going to download all that information onto our website. We're then going to create a system whereby people can also respond on the web, both giving us suggestions and responses to some of the proposals that we're making. That online conversation will be taking place over the span of the next several weeks. So I'd like everybody who wants to continue this conversation online to go to barackobama.com. There will be directions in terms of how you're able to access that. You're going to be able to type in your comments, your concerns, your questions. And it is at the end of this process where we will then start shaping our healthcare proposal. We will then submit that online to you for further comment and review. And it is at that point then, hopefully, that we will start. Not only will I deliver a speech, the usual conventional presidential speech where you're detailing your healthcare plan, but we're also going to have people who are signing on in support of the healthcare plan so that, again, it becomes part of a political process and movement to ensure that this time we actually get it done. Okay? Now, this gentleman, he's absolutely certain that he's got one point that is really, really important. Go ahead.
This morning I was curious, and I went down to Wentworth Hotel to see Giuliani. He spoke for 45 minutes. You have been speaking for 2 hours. We want to thank you for listening to all our woes, and we congratulate you.
Well, I appreciate that. This has been a great discussion. Thank you. Let me just... He wasn't a plant. I had nothing to do with selecting the people who came here. Let me just close by saying this, and it goes back to my original point. What's preventing us from doing this, look, these problems are complicated. They're not going to be solved overnight. But what's mainly been lacking is political will. We have to muster that political will. Some of you may have seen a while back, I was in Selma, Alabama, to celebrate the 42nd anniversary of the march across the Edmund Pettus Bridge, where, as you will recall, John Lewis and a group of ordinary folks, college students, maids, porters, they had marched across the bridge, were turned back by billy clubs and horses and tear gas. And there were a lot of people at that point who said, we are never going to get the right to vote. We're never going to overturn Jim Crow. It cannot be done. The forces against us are too powerful. The politicians are too corrupt. People are too set in their ways. And Dr. King came down the next day. He had been unable to participate in the first march. He gathered everybody together. And he said, the arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends towards justice. And they marched that next day, and thousands of people from all across the country came and marched across that bridge. And it was only a little while later that the Voting Rights Act was passed. And it just reminds us of something very basic about American history. And that is when millions of voices, when ordinary people make a decision that change is going to happen, it happens. It happens in fits and starts, but it happens. And the problem is when we decide that it can't be changed, then nothing happens. And so my goal in this campaign is to convince everybody that change can happen. And this campaign needs to be a vehicle for your hopes and your dreams, and you went a long way in doing that today with this wonderful forum. Thank you very much, everybody. Thank you.